Hello, and welcome to episode 93 of the Carrier's Edge podcast, coming to you hot from the West Coast in the James Bay studio. You held that together longer than I thought you would.
That was good. And who are you?
I am Mark Morrell, co-founder of Carrier's Edge. And as a break from our normal programs, I have a special guest today.
Jane Jazrowi, the other co-founder.
I'm being facetious, of course. It's always the same.
Mm-hmm. You always start out with a terrible, terrible opener.
Let's see, then we got nowhere to go but up.
Okay, good.
So here we are at the beginning of October and our second episode of this season. And we've got lots going on that we both needed to be reminded of because we have spent the last several weeks buried in marketing, doing campaign stuff.
Buried. Because creating a campaign is no mean feat. There's a lot of brain power that goes into it. Like you have to think, well, first of all, you have to think of it. Then you have to actually try and think of how you're going to do it visually. And then you have to actually make it.
And when you actually make it, every person that you need to deliver it to has their own completely different requirements.
What is it with different sizes? And I'm telling you, I am so irritated with social media and their different sizes. Not only do you have a different size for every, what do you call those? The backdrops for your...
The banners.
The banners. But there's three different sizes within the size that you have to do that account for the different devices. Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's insane. Like there's, Facebook, you can only basically just use the middle of the image now. Same with YouTube. You have to have this huge image and you can only use the middle. I think Twitter is the only one that's kind of normal.
And nobody uses Twitter anymore.
I know. And LinkedIn is different because it's got this really, really long, thin, horizontal banner. It doesn't do anything. Like you don't have to have 50 different versions, but... Oh, then they change. I have a bookmark to a place that tells me all the times that it changes, but I'm still not getting it right. So I need someone to just be in charge of that.
Well, and that was just the social media banners. That's not even getting into the actual ads.
I know the ads are even worse.
That was my misery as we're trying to produce the ads for the different places where we have these things running. And sometimes they're animated and sometimes they're stills. And we can do both in most cases. But this time I thought we're going to keep it a little bit simpler. And for a particular size, we will either do animated or we'll do still. We won't try and do both. We're not going to do a picture and a movie. It'll be one or the other. I thought that would simplify things.
No.
But there are so many different sizes. I mean, it used to be that when you're doing a display ad on the internet, there was like two sizes and that was it.
Yeah, kind of squarish and long and thin.
Yeah, there was like what's called the leaderboard that is wide across the top, but not too tall. And now even that, there's three variations of that. The boxes, there's two or three variations. There's a few sites that have created their own dimensions. And even though most of these magazines are using the same Google engine for serving out their ads, they all have different requirements. Some of them will take some in a particular format and some won't. So you have to build all of these things, build all the different size variations. And for movies, size variations are a pain. So you got to do all of that. And then you've got to package them up in different ways for all these different things. So we end up with, you have one ad that you're going to serve out and you've got like 200 different deliverables.
Yeah.
It is insane.
Well, I was trying to make a list of all the different things that I needed to get done because I was basically trying to say, okay, so for a still image, a still ad, okay, creative team, these are the things that I want. And it took me, 3 days to create a template of not even anything that was even like the actual ad. It was just the size.
Just the canvas with the different sizes you need.
Yeah.
Because every time I thought we had them all and I was looking through the documentation, like, oh, there's this one that we need to do. I totally missed that. Or we thought we had to do it this size, but actually we should have done it this other size instead. Oy.
Yes, it was a bit blacky. And on top of that, you have to make the ads so small. You have to make them a specific dimensions and you have to make them so small that any text that's in them is grainy. Because you're basically, and if you do anything besides a plain square, it's going to be grainy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just because it's at such a small size. So I tried to do some research on the internet to see if I could figure out how to make them clearer at small sizes. And I just found a bunch of arguments about how many, you know, is it points per inch or pixels per inch or dots per inch? And what is the best way to describe how awful it is and no one can do it and there's no answer? And why don't you use HTML5 but points per inch, dots per inch? Oh my God.
How dare you ask that question? You shouldn't have asked that. Now you're stupid.
Yeah, it was like the giant hammer came out of the computer and said, nope, bonk, bonk on the head.
Yeah.
Go to the cornfield. I don't know if now that is a very, very like old reference. I don't know if you even get that.
That was two references, actually.
Was it?
Yeah.
Bonk, bonk on the head and in cornfield, the cornfield.
Those are two different shows.
Two different Twilight Zones or two different shows?
One was a bonk, bonk on the head was a Star Trek episode.
Oh.
Cornfield was a Twilight Zone / Simpsons Treehouse of Horror
episode. No, the Twilight Zone came first.
Yeah, but they were two different shows.
Okay.
Your two references are from different shows.
Okay, I'm mixing my references.
Yeah. So we have been buried in advertising misery, and all of this is for the first ad in a series. And since pretty much everybody listening to this podcast has seen our ads before, you know that I cannot stomach having a single ad that runs endlessly. I have to have variations. So we have to do this for all the variations, and we will do, I think we're going to do 4 variations every quarter. So.
And there's 18 variations of the 4 variations. So basically,
but now we know what they are at least.
Yes.
Once you get the first one done, first one damn near kills you. Second one is painful, but okay. And then from the third one on, it's all right. And it just becomes process.
I'm thinking that doing animated ones and doing stills really not going to make that much difference.
Yeah, it's not easier with one or the other.
No.
But now we do have to rebuild them all in HTML5 so that they are crisp.
Yeah, and by the way, can you tell me how to do that? Because I'm out of brain cells.
It's not for you to do.
Right, I know. So
that's for somebody else.
But you have to tell me what to do.
I've already passed it to the platform team to do it.
Okay.
That's their job.
Okay. I meant to talk to you about that before, so.
Okay, well, here we are. Management meeting through podcast. So this is what we have been working on. And it has eaten up a lot of our brain power. But it isn't the only thing that we've been doing. So we've had a couple of other very interesting things happening over the last little while as well. So now that we've had this cleanse of ads and griping about the ads.
Oh, no.
Oh, we're not done with that yet?
Well, a cleanse of talking about it. I was going to say, we're still working on it. So.
Yeah, but now we can move on to a different
topic.
Yeah,
you've stopped working on it.
But. No, I haven't stopped working on it.
Wow, because you're coming up with different things?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
A minute ago about talking to the platform team about rebuilding them.
Okay. No, I thought you were talking about coming up with different taglines and things like
that.
Oh,
no. We've still got lots of that to do.
Okay.
Yes. But we've had a cleanse here. We've done our public purging of our griping about how all of the ads are completely different and why are all the magazines so totally different and how they do things.
And why isn't it easy to just do a Google ad?
And I got to say, I have said this before to all of the magazines and I will say it here as well. The tracking that you get on these things is terrible. They cannot tell you anything about what's happening. Drives me nuts.
I know.
Google captures everything under the sun as a data point. But the only thing that anybody can tell you is that an ad was clicked at a certain time during the month. Not where that ad was, what page it was on, who clicked it, where that person came from, what else they clicked, what their travel through the site was like. Google knows all of that information, but you cannot get it.
Well, you know, the internet.
Yeah.
Intelligence. Artificial.
Yeah. So anyway, I should stop just griping here.
Well, these are things that are solvable, but just, you know, nobody really cares that much about solving them. If it was valuable to the magazines or to Google to let people know who is clicking what, they would let us know.
Yeah, it's not valuable to them for us to have that information.
No. They don't want to share that information for a very good reason, because it's very valuable and it's their data and they're not giving it away. We're not paying enough to get that information.
Interesting. So I wonder, do the magazines have it and they're not sharing, or do the magazines not get it from Google?
My suspicion is that the magazines aren't getting it either.
It hasn't occurred to them to look.
Or it hasn't occurred to them to ask, or Google is making it difficult for them to get it, or they don't know what to do with the data that they're getting, or it's useless, or there's something going on that that data is there, but there are some barriers between us and them. And I don't think it's necessarily the magazines, because if the magazines had it, then they would have a different layer of pricing that if you paid more, then they would give you more data.
True.
I don't think they have it because they're not offering it to you at another cost.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yes. If they had it, they would sell it to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. As soon as anybody has any data like that, they sell it. The only people who don't sell data is us.
Damn, we missed an opportunity.
I'm thinking like, you know, maybe we should get on that bandwagon, but no.
I'm not doing it.
No, the whole point about the data that we collect from the best fleets is that it is not for consumption. It is for bettering the industry. It's for collecting and figuring out what the trends are, what the where things are going, how things are moving, what the obstacles are. We don't collect it so that we can turn around and sell it. Although it's crazy how things are sold. I got a message the other day from a magazine that I had never heard of before. And it was in like, I don't know, somewhere in the US. And honestly, nothing that I would even think about caring about. And it said, this other company, also I had never heard of, has sold your information to us. And we need to disclose that. And I'm thinking,
wow.
Oh, you know what? It was a European company, but it was an American company who had sold the data, or who had sold my information to the European company. But in Europe, you need to.
GDPR, they have to disclose it.
Yeah. I think they got it because I have been when you subscribe, that's the word. I had subscribed to a couple of UK learning newsletters, 15 years ago.
Right.
So my data is circling around the EU and is, you know, somehow being, I don't know, bought and sold and shipped back to me through these weird magazines I've never heard of.
But at least the Europeans will tell you that they're doing it.
Can you imagine if companies in North America told you when they had your data and asked you if it was okay if they used it?
Oh my God.
Could you imagine?
Huge chunks of the economy would just collapse because the vast majority of people would say no.
How much email would you get? Like that's a lot.
For the disclosures, yes.
It's crazy.
But then you would stop getting email because you would tell those people no and they would have to comply.
You would opt out.
Well, I think that's the other part of it is that in Europe, when people don't comply with these things, they get hit with massive fines.
Which I think is amazing. I think that's awesome. I'd love to know who's got my data.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people who aren't telling me obviously are trying to use it for their own nefarious purposes. But, you know, the companies who are actually trying to use it for a business purpose, if I'm not interested in your product, then it doesn't matter if you have my email address. I'm still not buying your product. So you may as well tell me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm not going to buy whatever weird HR thing you have because your HR is different than my HR and it's a different country and it doesn't make any sense. It's strange. But I did read on this topic, but slightly not on this topic. I read a really interesting article about junk mail, like the physical junk mail that you get. And it was a US article, so they were talking about the US mail. But Canada has the same kind of junk mail where you really can't control like all this. Well, you can, but you move into a house and you just get mail. You just get these newspapers and you get catalogs and you get, you know, things like ads and all that physical mail apparently is like an insane amount of paper. Like,
oh yeah,
the junk mail industry just uses so much of paper and it's so wasteful. And actually they were talking about the Sierra Club, because Sierra Club is an environmental group who reported on like the destruction of forests because just for junk mail.
That most people do not want.
No, nobody really want. Well, hang on. So one, the Sierra Club is apparently responsible for a lot of junk mail itself, which I thought was quite funny.
That is funny.
But it works. Physical junk mail actually does have a higher percentage of respondents than junk email.
So instead of doing all of these digital ads, we should have just done paper junk mail?
I don't think for our audience, I don't know if it would work. But if you're doing consumer goods or consumer services.
I can see in consumer goods.
Yeah.
Because people are always looking for coupons, and that's the coupon delivered directly to them.
Exactly. And people have to sort through that mail. Mm. You can't just delete it. Like, if you could just delete junk mail, then you probably would. But you're always kind of sorting it because you need to know if your any real mail is still in there.
You have to look at it.
Yeah. So I have looked at all kinds of garbage that I normally, if it came to me through email, I would just, you know, electronically make sure that I never saw it and move it directly to my junk mail because I'm not interested.
You would set up rules to just remove it.
I would.
Yeah. But physical mail, you can't really do that.
So, you know, it works. So all of those, you know, physical bits of paper that you get for real estate and, you know, like the local services that you can buy, it actually really, really, really works. What I thought was interesting was that you can get rid of your junk mail. It is a process. It is not easy. And it's different in the US and Canada. In Canada, I believe you can stop at your mailbox. You can tell Canada Post not to give you any junk mail.
Really?
You can do that through their website.
I would imagine they do not have an easy process for that.
No.
They do not want people to stop that because that's a big source of revenue for them.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what they were saying about the US Post Office, is that if they got rid of that, they would basically, that would be it if they didn't do that.
Yeah, there's no other thing keeping them alive.
Because in the U.S., they have made it so that the U.S. Post Office can't make money off a bunch of things.
Mm.
So they are kind of stuck with junk mail as their source of revenue. So on the one hand, you have this, nobody wants this mail that's kind of just kind of dumped on you. People don't like it, which is why it's called junk. But at the same time, is this major source of revenue from the post office so that you have to do it. But it's also, you know, all paper, and we're trying to not waste paper, but you're putting paper in the post office, like basically in mailboxes that people will just like directly throw away.
Except the portion that will buy something from that. And there's enough of those people doing it
that it's worth it.
It's worth it for the advertiser to keep doing it.
And it's also way cheaper to do junk mail.
Hmm.
It's a third of the cost of sending a physical, like of just sending a regular letter. It's a third of that or something like that. It's like some very small chunk of it.
Wow.
I know. What, go figure when you read things.
This is like a documentary channel.
I know. It's like a book report.
All right.
I know. What were we talking about?
I think we got here through advertising.
Yes.
Somehow, indirectly.
Well, I'm quite fascinated by advertising, about how people do it and what they do and the quality of what they're doing and, you know, the types of advertising that you can have, like sometimes, like where advertising is, you know, those park benches or the bus stop benches that said, you know, if you, your ad could be here,
yeah,
someone could be reading your ad now.
Well, it's funny because you've just been doing ads. So your head has been in that space of doing advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going down the rabbit hole that is how you do research for all of your content. And I was just reading the, this week we are putting out the blog post that was based on the August webinar where we talked about creating and updating courses that aren't regulatory. So how do you find all the information that needs to go in a course when it isn't posted on a government website? And a big part of that webinar was going down the rabbit hole into all of these different areas that seem to have nothing to do with what the actual content is, but it helps you to fill in pieces. It adds to the color palette, and that gives you all of that information that you can then start chopping back to build something what you need and have a complete picture of it that is real for the audience. And you're just talking about that, doing exactly the same thing. I can just see how your brain was working over the past month going through this advertising, doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, because I'm thinking about advertising. I'm not only thinking about what to put in the advertising, because I do all the creative for the advertising. Mark comes up with the copy and I do the creative, like the basic, come up with the idea. And when I'm doing it, it's kind of like what I'm doing with a course. Yeah, I do all this research and I think about it. But then when I'm thinking about advertising, I'm also thinking about not only what inspires me or what kind of ad I want to see, because that's the other thing. I don't want to create an ad that I don't want to look at. An ad has to be, I don't know. There's tons of different types of ads. There's You know, on the one hand, you've got the beautiful graphic Apple ad, which is always super creative and obviously so much money going into it. And then on the other hand, you have basically an ad that you see when you're playing a game on your phone, which is like possibly the lowest form of garbage there is, you know, which is basically a please click here and download my app. Like that's, they're just begging.
Please buy my product.
Yeah. And it's basically, that's what they do is they're doing a please download. So there's that spectrum. And I'm thinking, I want to be more on the Apple side. Like I want to be more of the, you know, look at the imagination that I've actually put into it. Not a please buy. But on the other hand, I'm also looking at the whole inner mechanics of advertising. And so why do I have to do all these different friggin' sizes? And why is it only these crazy dimensions like 250 by 300 or worse, 962 by 70? Like, why is it so tiny? And so my brain is thinking about advertising. So when I see an article online or even on paper, I'm drawn to it. So anything that has to do with advertising, oh, I'm looking at it. And so I not only immerse myself in advertising, but I'm thinking not just designing the ads, but the whole thing. And I actually, one of the things I did before I started designing the ads was I was listening to a podcast about Mad Men and the creation of Mad Men. And that's all about the advertising industry. And it started with the first episode starts with
the tobacco ads
when they had just, the Surgeon General had just said it causes cancer and the tobacco companies were really stuck and what are we going to do? And I find all of that really fascinating. And anytime I'm working on something and I'm really, really getting engrossed in it, I find it fascinating for that time period. And then I forget about it. I do. I have to, because I got to find something else that's fascinating.
Well, you create this elaborate mental palace and then live in it while you're doing that work.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it.
Yeah.
An elaborate mental palace and then I live in it.
Which is sort of made out of glass. And then at the end, it's gone. Right? It gets shattered. And if you have to go back to it, you can pick up the pieces of that. And if you really have to, you can put them all back together and rebuild it.
I wouldn't say it like that. I don't shatter anything. I just leave.
Yeah. And it kind of gets shattered by other things. Other things sort of push in, take over that place.
It gets pushed aside, definitely.
Yeah.
But I can go back to it and I can get immersed in it again.
Oh, for sure.
It doesn't take quite as long, but I don't, yeah, there's only so many of those I can do. And then I start forgetting things.
Mm-hmm.
Or I remember that I knew something about it and then I have to go and look at, yeah, it takes longer to access all of that information again after I've moved on to something else. So it's not just courses, it's everything for me. That's, you know, a blessing and a curse, right?
One thing at a time, but very deep.
Yes, yes, very deep. And I can't do surface because it makes me very anxious.
You wonder what else is there that you're missing.
Yeah, or how I can make it better and more perfect.
Yeah. And then in the middle of that, somebody comes in and throws a question at you about some other subject or like challenges a question on an HOS course.
Or comes into my office and asks me about, you know, what I want for dinner or
That's
something.
That's different. That's perfectly fine. But somebody comes in and says, hey, what about those CTPAT changes? You got those yet? And your head explodes.
So stressful.
Yes, because it's so different and you haven't gone into that world. But you will. You'll get there.
Well, I actually don't have to directly. I did a little bit because this, whatever the CTPAT updates are, I know there are some because I've had a couple of conversations about them, but I don't know what they exactly are. That's my anxiety, is I don't know. I'm looking and the information isn't super easy to find. So it's not impossible to find. I mean, we'll just find, I've got some of it. I just need someone to go into that rabbit hole for me and go and look at the old CTPAT course and see what's missing, which I think is maybe some agricultural exemptions, or not exemptions, but some practices. And I think that there's some new, there's a new set of requirements, and I think that has to be updated as well.
Hmm.
But I'm not totally sure, which kind of bugs me. I don't like the way that things are being updated these days. It seems like there's lots and lots of little updates, and they aren't doing the, okay, we're going to bunch up all these updates and then there's going to be like a release of updates,
yeah.
Which is what used to happen. It would be like, okay, you know, something 2020 is coming up.
Yeah, that was much better for us, that's for sure, because you can actually do the changes and then release a new course or update the existing course. This endless little change here, little change there is just a nightmare.
Well, we were updating the WMIS course to, this is Canadian WMIS, to for the changes this year, which are not major. I mean, they're really mostly documentation changes. It's not really any kind of super, like if you take the old WMIS course, you're still going to be safe. As far as I can see, we're doing the updates, but it's not like the rules have changed. It's just details about the rules have changed. So, but the thing is hilarious because this WMIS is supposed to be part of this global harmonized system. So everybody is using the same regulations and using the same documentation and same symbols and stuff like that. So Europe and North America and Asia and anybody who's part of this global GHS, global harmonized system, is going to be, you know, kind of all up to date and everybody can read everybody else's symbols, except for the US isn't going to update them.
Hmm.
And apparently they were going to, we found out today that nobody knows when those updates are going to happen. So they've just stopped having information sessions about it. So we're updating WMIS. WMIS is updated, but...
But HCS is not going to be.
Which is HASCOM. I call it HCS, but most people call it HASCOM.
So what's supposed to be a globally harmonized system, once again, will not be in sync.
It is absolutely... I don't think it's ever been globally harmonized.
No, it's been the globally discordant system, basically.
It's the... Yeah, the global, we'd really like to be harmonized system. Yeah.
Yeah, and it occurs to me that it's not great for the fleets as well, because it's nice to know there's a new version, there's new regs coming, new regs are live as of this date, we'll train all our people on it, and we'll be good. But if it's this moving target that's always changing, how do you keep your people trained sufficiently? You got to train them and then keep throwing out all of these, oh, update to this, update to that. Even like when we recommend people do regular refreshers and things like that, there's still this constant feeling of chasing things and never really being up to date on what you're doing.
Oh, yeah. It's insane.
How do you know? How much time do you have to devote in order to have confidence that you're really up to date or everybody is really up to date on everything? Like that's... It's really a problem.
We try.
Well, we're constantly updating our stuff and support is always putting out blog posts to notify people that there's changes coming and giving them lots of notice when they're swapping out courses and things like that. But the safety people at a fleet have got a lot of other things to do. That must just be a nightmare for them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, making sure that you're compliant with all the regulations that apply to you. Yeah, it's kind of a nightmare because sometimes you don't even know there's a regulation that does apply. And so, for example, you know, for us, I think we found out about safety committees because we did a course on safety committees. And then it was like, well, wait a minute, we need a safety committee.
Mm.
And then we're kind of exempt from it because we're all virtual. But it was really hard because we had to try and find someone at the Ministry of Labor to actually acknowledge that we were all virtual.
Yeah, they didn't know what to do with that pre-pandemic. Before COVID, they were like, well, you got to post up all your rules in a common place. Like, okay, where?
Yeah, like what is a common place when you don't have a physical structure?
Yeah, COVID fixed a lot of that stuff and they had to deal with it. So now there's actual answers, but it was a headache for a while.
Yeah. And I totally acknowledge that it is a nightmare to keep up with regulations and to keep up with what everybody needs to know. And it's very tempting to just try and find one system that's going to do it all for you. But I don't think that there really is one. You can't relinquish the responsibility of having to make sure that everything you need is that someone is doing that internally. You can't say, oh, we have this consultant or we have this vendor or we have this and that. Vendors can help, but they can't replace the responsibility that you have.
Now, that's an interesting point because it's a really nice seg into one of the other things that I wanted to mention that happened a couple of weeks ago was the webinar that we did with the lawyer, the litigation lawyer, to talk about driver training in the courtroom. And it's one I've been wanting to do for several years. And I was very happy to have Kevin Mulvaney from Wilson Elser come and talk about his experiences in litigation and specifically about driver training. Because there's all these sessions that you go to with lawyers and they basically say, well, document your training. You got to train your drivers and document the training. And what people take away from that is you have to do orientation and document it. And I knew there had to be more than that and had to be a lot more to it in terms of what people can be doing, where are they places where you're going to get help, where the places that are going to be a problem for you in the courtroom. And he was fantastic. And he went through all of that stuff. But one of the things that came up was this idea that there really is no magic recipe that you can follow. And this came up in the questions as well. Like this was a webinar that had 250 people registered instead of our normal like 70 or so. And they were like loaded with questions the whole time. And a lot of the questions were, if I do ABC, will I be safe? If I do this, will I be safe? And the answer in every single one of those is, it depends. It depends on what else you're doing, how you're doing it, what else is going on in different sections. There's no black and white answer to any of it. And that whole business of, am I really up to date on it? You're not going to get one vendor who can say, yes, if you do this, you're going to be perfectly up to date. One of the things that did come up is the importance of getting outside consultants to come in and review it, that outside perspective. And Kevin really liked that idea of using outside consultants to come in and look at these things periodically and assess it and give you some feedback that you can use so that you don't have blind spots in your program, because you might think that you're up to date or that you've got all of the current regulations, and then some outside person comes in and looks at it and they can have a really good perspective of, well, you've got most of it, but you missed this thing, or this part here could be misunderstood or something like that. So that ended up being really helpful.
And I think that, and related to that is the importance of documentation, so that documenting what you did when something happened, mm-hmm. like how you responded to something happening, the importance of having that documentation there is super important, especially if you're trying to go back and look at, you know, did we manage this risk? And we can't do that for every company.
No.
All we can do is provide some of the content that people need to know. And we can give you tests so that people can show that they have, you know, mastered that content. And one of the things that I had a conversation, or we had a conversation with Chris Harris, who's a risk consultant, about test 100.
Correct to 100.
Oh, sorry. Correct to 100.
Which is another thing that comes up as a question, that people have this idea that if they force drivers to get perfect on a test to pass, that they're somehow going to be diligent, that that's going to remove any claim of negligence, when it absolutely doesn't.
No,
doesn't help at all.
It absolutely doesn't. And correct to 100 or mastery tests are kind of, I'd say they're misinformation. They're kind of they're a made up thing that trucking.
It's a red herring.
Yeah.
Or a placebo.
Somewhere, somehow, and we think we know the source of it, but we don't know. At some point, someone said, well, you know, if you want to make sure that your drivers really know it, then we can make the passing score 100. So you have to get 100%. And then people are always like, yeah, that's a great idea. Except for the fact that, is that how you want to pass a test? Have you ever had to get 100 to pass any test in your life?
Yeah.
Like no one.
Certainly the lawyer cross-examining you didn't have to get perfect pass the bar.
To pass the bar? Absolutely you don't have to get perfect. Your SATs, you don't have to get perfect. Your high school tests.
CDL.
Your spelling tests in grade 4, you don't have to get 100 in order to be a competent speller. You have to know enough that you can competently function in that particular area, but you absolutely don't have to get 100. And there is no educational, I don't want to say philosophy, but there's nothing to back that up. There's no
data. Research that shows it. There's no benefit to it. It's one of those things that people think is going to help them. And I think the argument on the other side from the sales guy selling it as well, how can you let somebody going out on the road knowing that they don't have all the information that they need? Like, that's pure negligence right there.
But they didn't even get 100 on their CDL.
Well, also, even if they do get 100, it doesn't mean that they didn't guess it. You know, how do you know for sure? Did you talk to them? You know, there's so many other things that can be happening there. Maybe they didn't get 100% because your questions are written poorly and they confuse people. That doesn't mean somebody doesn't know it.
Or that the person understands it but doesn't have the command of the English language. There's tons of reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had people who are experts in the field go through our tests and not get 100. So
yeah. recognized experts.
Yeah, risk consultants. Yeah. They still think it's a great test. They still think it's a great course. They, you know, sometimes they say, well, you should probably change that question. And sometimes they say, you know what? That stumped me. That's good. And what a course and a test should do is not be a panacea like that, but it should.
Hang on. Is it panacea or panacea? Whichever.
Okay. One of those. But when people are doing a test, if you really, really want to look diligent, then follow up with them on the questions they got wrong.
Which was exactly what the lawyer recommended. Follow up after training. You cannot just do online training or any kind of training, file it away and ignore it. You can't do online and then leave the results and not talk to drivers after any more than you can have somebody go to orientation, scribble in that they attended, and then call that training and not do anything.
And then put them in a truck.
Well, and one of the things that comes up often is they'll have this super diligent orientation because they're super focused on onboarding people. You know, often fleets that have high turnover, they will be so focused on onboarding and make sure people know all the stuff they need to know when they get going. And then they forget about the people that have been there for 5 years or 10 years and they don't really get any training. And that's deadly in court because then it looks like they didn't care about that driver. Once he got out on the road, they didn't care. They didn't bother training him again.
And on that note, the way that a lot of fleets are doing online training is a problem when you're trying to be diligent. They're throwing that monthly training thing and just not going over it, not reviewing it, not incorporating it into anything else that a fleet is doing, talking to them about their camera, you know, every single, you know, lane departure, giving them a call and saying, oh, I saw this on the camera and now I'm going to give you some, you know, something on online training, but I'm not going to bother, you know, relating those things. So you have to, I think that fleets could really just stop with the online training every month. Like really, really, like rethink.
Well, we've talked
that
about that a few times. We've written articles about how to do it instead and like do something quarterly and then do some other types of intervention, do a meeting or do a survey or have some, like all the stuff that you have and you're put into practice activities. There's lots of different things to be doing. And all of those, as it turns out, are exactly what helps in court because it shows that the company cares. The theme that came out of that webinar is that in every legal situation, the plaintiff's attorney is going to try and show that the fleet doesn't care about safety, like didn't take it seriously, or prioritize profit first. So anytime they cut a corner on something, anytime they use some free product instead of actually investing in something, anytime they didn't put all their people through training because they wanted to save a buck, anytime they didn't bother following up, anytime that they didn't put any real thought into it, it just looks like they don't care about safety. And that's going to be the whole theme. And that's the stuff that the plaintiff is going to be hammering home to the jury the whole time.
Is there a way that people can see this, the webinar?
Why, yes, there is, Jane.
Good thing I asked, eh?
Well, we're writing a blog from this, of course. I'm quite sure this will end up as an article that we put in a magazine somewhere because there's a ton of great information on it. The webinar recording is on our website right now. Well, actually, it may not be. With this month, it will go up on the website. We do have a little bit of a lag putting those up. We have the recordings available to people who registered first, and then we make it available to the general public.
Okay, but if someone listens to this podcast and wants the,
they should,
wants the recording?
If they were to mail me or contact support, we can get them a copy of it.
Okay. Yeah. So let's see if anybody actually...
It was very popular. I tell you, we burned through that hour in no time, and there was probably a dozen questions afterwards.
Do you think that we should bring Kevin back?
I think that would be very popular. Yes. These kind of sessions are always very popular. The same as when we have a webinar with one of our insurance partners or risk consultant going through what they find when they go on site or things that they look for, what helps or hurts for insurance renewal, like all of those kind of things are always very popular.
Well, I mean, that doesn't really surprise me. I mean, it's kind of, you know, if you've never really experienced it and you're not sure what you should be doing and you don't know what to ask, then coming to a session like that gives you kind of an overview. It gives you a place to ground yourself.
Yeah.
So they're very valuable. So that's why I think that we should bring him back.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, it was very well received. He's a very good speaker. I mean, I met him at an event I did with BFL Insurance back in April, and he spoke very well there. Had some really good insights. And I got lucky because everything that he recommended is like all the things that we tell people. And everything he said not to do is all the things we tell people not to do. It was perfect. It was like I went and found a lawyer who agrees with all of our stuff. But it was also really reassuring because, you know, sometimes we have these philosophies about the things that we think people should be doing. And we can seem crazy because often we're very different from others. And it was really nice to have a lawyer saying, no, this is the right way of doing it. Like, you know, the whole cutting corners and making sure you're making training only 10 minutes or 5 minutes or whatever, like any of those kind of things that I think are ridiculous. He agreed that that's ridiculous. Or, you know, getting rid of your real program and just using some stuff that you've found for free on the internet, like YouTube stuff or whatever. And he said, oh my God, like that's disastrous. You know, and his answer on some of these was, if I was a plaintiff's attorney, I would love that, which is not ever what you want to be. So
it's not what you want to be hearing.
Yeah. So that was, it was really good that way. I very much enjoyed the session. For me, it was very, I don't want to say vindicating, but it was reaffirming that all the things we're talking about are right.
One of the things that I'm kind of going to come back, because I don't think that you need to feel reassured or anything like that. We are using best practices.
Yeah.
And it's, I think what the issue is that we hear so much about people not using best practices. We know what the best practices are because we have been in the education business. We've been in corporate education and know what those best practices are because we've basically, that we lived this for years. And when you come into an industry where those best practices, one, are not being followed, and two, where you have some vendors who are saying the exact opposite because that's how they want to sell their own product that is not based in best practices, that's, you start feeling like you're losing your mind.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, am I crazy?
Yeah, I guess that was it. It made me feel more sane. Or it reassured me that I'm not crazy with all of these ideas.
Because I don't think that you just found a lawyer who agreed with you. I think most lawyers are going
to
agree.
No, the reason that it's taken me this long to get this session together is finding a lawyer that I actually met who is in this space, who was available to do this kind of work and to be part of something like this and could speak decently. And, you know, a lot of these lawyers are great for briefs and for writing and research, and they're not necessarily great speakers. But
yes,
finding somebody who is a good speaker, who was available, who knew the material and focused on the U.S. litigation market, which is what I really wanted to see. So that was really helpful. So there we go. A very good session.
Yeah, that's cool.
We've got a couple of minutes. So let's just sort of recap a little bit what we're up to, because we both got some events happening that we should do some plugs for and talk about that a little bit. So you've got a fun adventure coming up in 2 weeks in Las Vegas. And what's happening there?
I am. I'm going to DeliveryCon, which is a conference for final mile providers. And I will be talking about some best practices for recruiting and retention from the best fleets. So I'm going to be doing some best fleets talking. And I think it's going to be an audience that is a little unfamiliar because this conference is a new one. This is
brand new conference.
It's a new conference from Bobbitt Media. And I can't remember the exact dates.
I think it's the 14th to 16th or something like that. It's like that Monday to Wednesday.
If you go to deliverycon.com, then that's where you can find all the information. But it's in Vegas.
And that's interesting that it's final mile people. So it's a lot of different types of vehicles than what we are looking at in the Best Fleets program. But so much of the stuff carries over.
Yeah. Well, it's people, right? It's not, you know, drivers are not fundamentally different from anyone else. They have been historically not treated that well. And a system has been created where, you know, a driver has been easily replaced. So it's not that terrible if you treat them kind of subpar and they go on their, you know, leave your company and then you can just get another one. And that happened quite quickly, or that problem was quite exacerbated in the long haul over the road industry, but it is also in the, you know, in the final mile industry where people are doing the same thing. There's not enough people. The people who are really good at their job are walking because they don't like it. There was an issue with UPS. The, I don't know, I guess it was the Teamsters had a deal with UPS to get a lot more money than other companies. So that, you know, how do you combat that? Mm. You know, what do you do when there's more money being offered by one company than what you can offer? Well, the best fleets have been dealing with that for quite a while because there are some companies that pay really well, or they say they pay really well, but in reality, are they really paying well? And it's the same thing with this situation where there's a lot of gotchas in that, you know, there is higher pay that's available. But is it available to you? Hmm. Is it available to everyone? No. It's available to a certain number of people, but it's the carrot that's being dangled in front of you. Just like, you know, you can make 90 grand a year working for us, but only if you get all the good routes all the time, and which is not going to be the case.
Yeah, and also often used in place of other things. You pay people a lot more when you have to because you're not providing a place where they want to be.
Yeah.
Right. You provide a place where people want to be and you don't necessarily have to pay as much.
Exactly.
You'll have to pay competitive, but not as much. So yeah, very good. Well, I am going to be talking very specifically about best fleets to and with best fleets. So I'm doing a session at ATA's management conference and exhibition the same week. This one is in Austin and I'm doing a 1-hour breakout session. What do they call an education session, where I'm going to be talking a little bit about the program, summarizing some of the things that we found, a couple of tidbits on that. And then I'm going to be interviewing Jim Guthrie from Prime and Phil Wilt from American Central Transport about some of the things that they're doing and how they go through the program, what they do with the information, why they got involved, and sort of talk about their process around the program, but also some of the things that they've learned that are useful for other fleets. So ways they've learned how to do things from looking at the information, you know, how they collaborate, how they get their drivers engaged, all of that kind of stuff. So it's going to be a little bit of a, here's how the program works and why you should get involved, but it's also going to be a little bit of, here's some useful information that we get through the program so you can get some value even if you don't participate.
And I would like to just point out that Mark and I are going to be not together for the first time.
In a while.
Yeah.
Well, like, no, I guess since May. I went to 2 events without you in May.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like, actually, did you fly? Oh, no, that's right. You did. You flew.
It was at the private fleet conference and the tank truck conference.
It's the first time since we've been on the West Coast.
Yep.
And we're both going to be flying out of Victoria International Airport and
into different destinations and on different airlines.
Different airlines. So that's going to be weird.
So our next episode, we will have an update.
We will.
We'll have a summary of those events.
We'll be back in the basement. Oops, sorry. Studio.
The James Bay recording facility. Whatever I called it at the beginning.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap us up for today. So thanks, everyone, for listening.
Yeah. Have a good day.